How is Mickey Mouse partially responsible for you not being able to afford your allergy medication? Well, it's a silly disaster of a tale. Find out on Seemingly Unrelated. Welcome back to Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast where we untie the knot of life's invisible mysteries by connecting the seemingly mundane moments of everyday life to the most unbelievable but true stories and events across history. If this is your first time joining us, here's the premise. Every episode, Dr. Mr. Professor Sir Andrew Johnstone has prepared a journey that connects all of those things I mentioned before. And I come in, and just like you, I'm flying blind. I know nothing. I am unprepared and proud of it. I am your host. I am Jason Heat. I am a writer, director, producer, podcaster. Obviously, I also live deep in the world of professional wrestling, but I can't do it alone. As always, I am joined by the big brain behind it all, the general of the good ship Unrelated, Andrew Johnstone.
Yes, thank you. I am Dr. Andrew Johnstone, allegedly a lecturer in culture, media, and society at University of Glasgow. Sorry, it's a new job.
And of course, we have with us our producer, our editor, our Gen Z ambassador. She is the one that makes our triangle isosceles, but not isosceles. It's Naomi.
Hello.
Doctor, where do we start from today?
You know, recently, my father-in-law, he had a Disney Plus subscription that he accidentally signed up for. And yeah, it's a thing. And so I have been, you know, surfing through, because obviously I just created a profile for myself. That's what you do when someone accidentally acquires a Disney Plus subscription. And it got me thinking, Jason, what do you know about the corporation known as the Walt Disney Company?
I mean, that's a big and broad question. Do you want to talk about theme parks? Do you want to talk about cartoons? Do you want to talk about animation? Do you want to talk about hospitality? Like, I'm not ignorant.
I would like you to tell me, when you were a child, what was your first experience with Disney? Where do you tie your emotional grounding with the Disney Company?
Oh, I mean, my heart when it comes to Disney was the Disney Afternoon. I don't actually know whether or not that was my first experience with them, but the Disney Afternoon, because Naomi will not know what this is, was a lineup of half-hour children's programming centered around different Disney properties that were often, at the beginning, updates or sort of reimaginings of some of their classic characters. And I've gone off on a tangent. Where did you actually want this to go? No,
but you know what? But a beautiful tangent, because Naomi, please.
I was just going to say, before we kick off, I hate Disney.
You hate? Now,
I think it's really bad.
You don't like Disney the brand? You don't like Disney the company, because it's bad
that's
for the
fair,
world for there
the
to be, like, you don't like any Disney character. I just think that's too broad.
Like,
I don't like
Disney Pixar. Every other Disney film I've watched, I thought was really annoying. Because I think it just really follows the hero's tale. I feel like I know what's going to happen in the first 10 minutes. It annoys me, all of the cliches, and it annoys me how everyone wants me to watch it all the time. And I grew up and doing theatre things, and everyone thinks Disney is like the epitome of filmmaking, and it annoys me. I've said it.
I feel like...
Can I just say that is on brand, Naomi?
I'm just curious, when you say this, though, are you specifically referring to the Disney animated cartoons? Because Disney is a is a massive company that does so much more than what you're referring to. Or are you just referring to, like, the classic?
It's every film I've watched that's been a Disney film.
But you also mean live action? Like, do you know that Disney makes tons of live action movies?
Princess Diaries?
Oh, I like Princess Diaries.
There's no chance that you are aware of the vast catalog of movies you're referring to.
I'm talking about the animated ones. There we go.
Great.
I do love that you jumped into the Disney afternoon, though, because one, it's a lovely memory because we all, yes, we very much as children enjoy that. But it's also super relevant to today's topic. Let's take a walk down memory lane and go back to the origins of Walt Disney Studios. So back in the 1920s, young Walt Disney and his partner, Ub Iwerks, great name, and I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation on it, made a bunch of short films based on Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, and they took that money from those short silent films, and they bundled it together to open up Walt Disney Studios in January of 1926 down in Los Angeles. And the very first thing that Walt wanted to do was to leverage the popularity of these silent animated short pictures like Felix the Cat and create his own unique, outstanding character that we all know super well and we love dearly in our hearts to this day. Of course, I mean Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, right? Have you any experience with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, Jason?
No, I am not. I mean, I'm sure I do, but I understand your bait and switch there as you were leading us towards Mickey Mouse and then pulled us away.
Pulled the rug.
I thought you were going to say Peg Leg Pete because he was also in Steamboat Willie.
Yes, very early character. No, but Oswald is the first original. That's why I'm glad you mentioned you like the original characters more, Jason. It's the first original creation from Walt Disney, not based on an existing intellectual property. It's a, well, it's black and white silent film, so it's a black rabbit with sort of white short trousers on. And he's like plucky, and actually the exact words I believe are venturesome, saucy, and peppy. Oh, Disney. And it's 1926, so Walt Disney doesn't have the cash to distribute Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. He can make an Oswald the Lucky Rabbit short, but he needs a studio to release it, and luckily the one of the producers at Universal Studios, Margaret Winkler Mintz, she offered to distribute Disney's short in exchange for a share of the profits of that film. What do you think the split was between Universal Studios and Walter Disney in 1926-27 on the Oswald the Lucky Rabbit shorts, Jason?
It was unfavorable for Walter.
Yeah. He was only allowed 20% of the profits. So after a few years of making Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, he gets enough money out of that 20% of the profits that he could distribute the character himself. But no, sir. Not on the contract that Universal had signed with him. This was a locked in. If you're going to make Oswald cartoons, they have to be distributed by Universal for a set period of time or a certain number of films. And looking ahead, Walt realized he would not be able to sustainably produce Oswald the Lucky Rabbit shorts if he were to continue working under Universal's system, which is why in 1928, Jason, he made the legally distinct character of Mickey Mouse, and he premiered Mickey Mouse in November of 1928 with Steamboat Willie, which not only separated Mickey from Oswald, but of course also introduced synchronized sound for the first time into an animated production.
Also, by the creation of Mickey Mouse, was clearly testing the boundaries of legally distinct copyright law.
He's got gloves.
He's got gloves?
He's got gloves, a mouse? Short ears. But it is Mickey Mouse that launches an empire, right? Like, to this day, what is the symbol of Disney when you go into the parks?
Mickey Mouse ears.
You get the mouse ears.
Dollar bills.
And man, an insane amount of money.
Mickey, right? And money, baby.
Mickey and buddy. Yeah, the ear, just that little symbol is like one of the 10 most recognizable symbols in the world. And who owns the rights to Mickey Mouse, Jason?
The Walt Disney Corporation.
The Walt Disney Corporation owns the rights to Mickey Mouse.
Well, the Walt Disney Corporation owns the rights to the vast majority of Mickey Mouse. But technically, the original version of Mickey Mouse, Steamboat Willie, that initial is now in the public domain.
Yes, the film itself, Steamboat Willie, is now in the public domain. But that shouldn't be a huge problem, right? Because for Disney, as you have rightly pointed out, Jason, fairy tales, public domain stories, are the bedrock of their whole business model. Like, they have these original characters like Mickey, like Chippendale, like Donald Duck.
Once they moved to film, the original characters were the bedrock of their cartoons and their shorts and the animated. And then once they made the move to feature films, taking on public domain stories became the bedrock of their...
Yeah.
And could you just define public domain just for any listeners?
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. So... a public domain simply means that a piece of intellectual property, an idea, a patent, a character, a story, something that was created by a person, now can be used publicly.
Specifically a conceptual thing. We're not talking about objects or...
Yes.
Basically, so it's putting on a legal definition of property for a concept as opposed to a physical item.
Right. It's not – yeah, the physical copies of Steamboat Willie are not in the public domain, but you can legally make a copy of Steamboat Willie and distribute it as you see fit because it is now publicly available. It is now in the domain of the public, hence public domain.
And specifically, I should say, Naomi, not owned by an individual or an estate. Whereas before, in order to get access to Steamboat Willie, I would have to license that from Disney. Or, for example, in the past, let's say, you know, license Sherlock Holmes from the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle. When something goes into the public domain, you are able to do with it what you will without having to get any kind of permission or paying for it.
Yes. Now, there, it gets a little trickier beyond that, but there's no need to dig in there. We'll get to where we need to get to when we get there.
Because surprisingly, or unsurprisingly, early American copyright law did not account for the length of time, like the perpetual nature of certain characters being in the public sphere and making money, or corporations owning the rights to these characters instead of individual authors.
And we're going to talk exactly about that, Jason, because I have a really important question for you. What's the difference between longitude and latitude?
It goes up and down versus east and west, north and south versus east and west, up and down, side to side to side. The world's a globe.
Which one goes up and down and which one goes left and right on a globe?
I think long... is north and south, and latitude is east to west, but I could be wrong.
Right. Lateral, you're right. Lateral moves that way, east-west, and then longitudinal moves north and south. Now, latitude is something that is actually shockingly easy to figure out. We've been calculating latitude as a species for a couple thousand years. Really, you just kind of need a sundial. And you can calculate it using like the angle of the sun. It is for people who are in the know, not difficult. But longitude, Jason, that's a different beast altogether. What were you about to say?
Well, I know that the whole point of the show is somehow you're going to connect these things, but what the fuck does this have to do with Steamboat Willie?
I'll tell you what it has to do with Steamboat Willie. See, it's 1707. There was a horrible naval disaster in the Isles of Scilly. The Scilly Isles naval disaster of 1707 claimed the lives of 2,000 sailors.
That is really unfortunately named.
I'm going to pause. Probably let Jason go on that one.
This sounds like a Mickey Mouse short. Ooh, Goofy and Donald have a silly naval disaster. Donald's even a member of the Navy. Like, how has this not been adapted into a DuckTales episode? Anyway, it was probably tragic.
It was really tragic. I mean, 2,000 people died. The Scilly Isles, by the way, are just a small archipelago to the southwest of Cornwall. So basically, as far west as England goes is the Scilly Isles. And it's spelled S-C-I-L-L-Y. It is an area that has been settled since the Neolithic, at least, period, possibly the Paleolithic period, and is one of the contenders for maybe being the Atlantis that Aristotle was talking about, but unsure. So when that happens, when 2,000 people die, clearly Parliament has to take action, right? And they were so fast that 7 years later, they passed the Longitude Act of 1714. So the problem with the silly naval disaster was that Longitude...
Aside from its unfortunate name.
Longitude was very difficult to calculate. So the process of determining longitude up to this point was through a process called dead reckoning, where you would basically look at a fixed object and using like the best data available you had on you, on your like speed and direction, which basically would be like, okay, the sun's over there and it's like roughly 4 o'clock. So I know that that's like west. And then your speed would be in knots. You've probably heard this, right? Boats measure their speed in knots.
Yes.
You would literally just tie a bunch of knots in a rope equidistant apart, throw a heavy object in, and then count the number of knots that passed in a given amount of time. That was your speed. And with that, you could be like, okay, then we are here on the map, right? You need that for navigation, because if you don't know where you are on the map, I don't know if you've been to sea, Jason.
Oh, yes.
He's at sea right now.
Noted.
Noted.
Noted sea enthusiast Jason, who is so scared of dying in
every way.
Every way that I definitely have spent a lot of time at sea.
At sea.
Yeah.
But for it's hard. Sure. If you don't know, if you don't have a consistent way to calculate longitude, regardless of like visibility, like if it's foggy, for example, if you don't have that, you don't know where the hell you are. Like it's very difficult to navigate.
Well, there's only one thing you need. There's only one thing to do at this point. You call a steamboat and you have it travel the entire globe from north to south.
And that's the Seemingly Unrelated.
Yeah, Steamboat Willie was a documentary. So
it sounds like currently they're just guessing.
Yes.
But they're looking and they're like, the sun's here. It's probably this.
Yes. Dead reckoning is more of a hypothesis than anything. It's an educated guess. So they needed then to find a consistent way to calculate longitude, right? And so the Longitude Act of 1714, again, I want to note, 7 years after the silly naval disaster, offered a 10,000 pound prize, equal today to 1.5 million pounds, to anyone who could reliably calculate longitude on a transatlantic or transpacific, it doesn't matter, but a really long sea voyage. Thus enters the hero of our story, John Harrison, right? Who is a carpenter and a self-taught clockmaker who had an idea, right? So he had an idea for a new kind of clock. So when you think of an old clock, Jason, what do you think of? Oldest clocks you could think of. Might see it in your house.
Big Ben?
No, old clocks, not big clocks. Like, does your grandparents ever just have an old clock in the house?
Yes.
How does it work? How does an old clock work?
It tells time. I don't
know. It tells time!
I'm an artist, not an engineer. There are gears, and it... as far as I know, isn't there like a... Like, if I watched cartoons, isn't there like a cuckoo bird in there? Or like...
You know what? That's fair. That's relevant. No, he's a pendulum, right? We think of like a grandfather clock. There's a little thing, right, that swings. And sometimes you have to go and adjust the weights.
Sure, I'm going to believe you because you're saying it and like that's your job on the show.
Does
no one
know how clocks work anymore? Most clocks before the 18th century, in fact, I would argue almost all clocks that weren't sundials, had a pendulum system. They would have a weight that would swing back and forth, and that would cause the gears to turn in a fixed pace, and that's how you could consistently report time. Again, you've not been to sea much, but the one thing I'm sure you know...
much. Asterisks. Ever.
Ever. The one thing I'm sure you do know about on a boat is they tend to rock back and forth. So, like... Obviously, a pendulum-based clock, right, isn't going to work because it needs to swing back and forth, but the boat is also swinging back and forth, so they get out of sync immediately.
I'm just thinking about Oswald the Rabbit and trying, like, potentially the greatest episode you've ever done, because I have no fucking idea where this is going.
I love it.
But sure. Yeah, the pendulums and the boat rocks and people get sick and it's hard, you know, and knots and stuff.
Naomi's dad, loving this episode so far. He is into it. He's like, oh yeah, the grandpa knocks. And
I've only cursed once or twice, I think.
So. Yeah.
And Harrison, I'm so sorry, sir.
And now for something completely unrelated.
So Harrison makes...
Should we give the context of my dad told us off for swearing, which made me feel like a little child. And I came back and I went, my dad told you you're really bad for swearing. So there we go.
Yes, we will keep the swearing down, sir. Flipping heck, I suppose, would be more appropriate. So John Harrison, Jason, is attributed with being the first inventor, technically, of a clock with two interconnected, like, spring balances, which is where you get the winding from. That was his idea, because if it uses the spring system instead of the pendulum, then, I will not get into the details, using spherical trigonometry, invented by Arabs in the 7th century to help them figure out where Mecca is, then you can measure the distance between where you are and where Greenwich is in the world using whatever local time is. So this is where Greenwich Mean Time comes from. GMT.
Is that
supposed
to mean something to me?
So you, Jason, live in GMT minus 5. You are 5 hours behind GMT. All the time zones of the world.
As I refer to it, EST.
During the wintertime, EST. We're in daylight savings right now, and we're in British summertime over here. But GMT, which is now also called UTC, but that's a different story altogether, was invented at this time for the purpose of longitude. Every time zone, roughly, used to correlate to longitudinal ranges.
Legitimate question. Where is Greenwich in the UK?
It's in London. It is in East London.
It's in London.
I mainly only know Greenwich because I know Greenwich Village, and I only know Greenwich Village because that's where Doctor Strange lives.
Is he in Greenwich? I thought he was. No, you're right. He's in Greenwich. Yep. Okay.
He's in Greenwich.
Fair enough. The
I
OG
learned most
Greenwich.
Of my New York geography because of Marvel Comics.
So Hell's Kitchen is massive as far as you're concerned.
I got so
Daredevil
excited
jokes.
When driving through Westchester.
I had no idea what anyone was talking about.
You might like Daredevil because you might not see where it's going. He certainly can't.
Was I meant to find that funny?
He's blind. He's a blind superhero, Naomi. The joke was that.
That
I'm
was
glad
good.
You explained the joke
thank
to me.
You. Yes, thank you. John Harrison, in 1735, so 20 or about 30 years after the silly naval disaster, he invents a new kind of clock which will make longitude easy to calculate.
So now I'm not joking. I'm actually asking. So there's the silly naval disaster.
Yes.
Then 7 years later, they put out the prize.
Yes.
And so you're telling me that 23 years after that is the first time that somebody is able to solve it and basically, like, claim the prize?
Yes. Many people tried. So, like, there were plenty of people who had great ideas that just didn't work consistently. But this this is just the first person to come with what we will know later as the marine chronometer.
But it was actually 27 years after they first put it out.
Yes, exactly. Now, he presents his findings to the commission that was nominated by Parliament, and they're like, this is a great invention. Thanks, we'll have it now. And he's, whoa. Excuse me. I invented this. I would like to own the rights to license this design so that people can, you know, make this, manufacture it, or maybe he'll manufacture it, whatever, however he wants to set things up. And Parliament was like, no, bro, we're giving you 10 grand now. That's it. You take your 10 grand, and there'll be no more discussion of it. It will become the public domain. 1735, like you said, we're about 30 years out from the disaster. We're like 23 years out from the commission coming together. How long do you think it took for the legal dispute to be settled over the designs of the marine chronometer?
My guess is that John Harrison was dead by that point and that this is the invention of the patent.
No, he was not dead, but he was pretty old. Because he was eventually got his price, he got his £10,000 in 1770, at which time he released his designs and the marine chronometer became a publicly available invention, like design.
Oh, so he lost.
He lost. Well, I mean, he got his money. He did get his 10 grand, but he never got the patent that he was looking for.
But that's what he wanted, so he lost. Like, he could have, if all he wanted was 10 grand, he could have had that then.
He did not have this natural right to an idea that didn't exist. That did not exist in Britain in the 1700s.
Shocking that Britain didn't acknowledge natural rights. Yeah.
And so it has been calculated that his withholding of this information, because Parliament did not settle an intellectual property dispute, could have killed as many as 1.2 million people. And the way we calculate this is after the marine chronometer becomes available, if you calculate the number of shipwrecks that happened per capita over the next 35 years, compare them to the number of shipwrecks for the 35 years beforehand, the difference? Stark.
I'm excited to learn how many lives Mickey Mouse has saved because he was copyrighted.
Because he was copyrighted. So this is really the fulcrum of the intellectual property debate when it starts. The whole push for intellectual property begins at the marine chronometer, really. There are some debates back and forth beforehand, but this like idea of if you make something, you have a right to its licensing and its distribution and its production and reproduction does not start until the marine chronometer. But it does not become written law until 1789. Something happened in 1789, Jason, in the good old United States of America. Please tell me. You know what happened in 1789 in the United States? It is maybe the most important thing. God, the Maryland came out there.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
That was nuts.
That was the most Maryland I've ever been. It was maybe one of the most important things that has ever happened. Possibly.
We're getting blank faces from Jason right now.
Wait. Did we sign the Constitution?
We didn't sign it, but you're super close. Super close. We drafted it. We wrote the United States Constitution.
Constitution. I'm going to give myself a B.
Thank you. I would also give you a B because you were at least in the right zone.
I knew what document we were talking about. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what part of the process it was.
1789, Jason, Constitutional Convention. As you've already alluded to, the U.S. Constitution has a clause known as the Intellectual Property Clause. And it says, and I quote, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries.
What a bunch of hippies!
Yeah. Those founding fathers, what a bunch of woke, liberal, no, they're all slave owners. Anyway, this is because of the marine chronometer. This was like a buzz in all the papers that people are reading and writing back to each other. This idea of like, well, this marine chronometer has really changed everything. And we must, I don't know why I'm like a early 20th century guy. We must ensure that for the United States to be this world power, what we should do
is invest in ideas and technology.
Invest in ideas. We don't have the infrastructure. Let's invest in ideas, right? And so there's like a load of prizes similar to the one that Parliament launched that are all designed to to invent, to promote people to invent things, to create things. But on the back end, they're guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. These commissions don't have to promise this to anyone. It's baked into the Constitution that you have a right to that intellectual property.
Imagine if we had created an amendment at some point that specifically guaranteed that all intellectual property was the right to its creator rather than a corporate overstructure or its, you know, distributor, and that those things were inherently separate.
Yeah, if only. But no, that's not how that works. Ask Jack Kirby.
But theoretically, I know it would never happen, but that is theoretically something that could be introduced into law.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that would be dead easy. That is, by the way, well within the purview of the rights of Congress.
Right.
Because the whole clause is justified in the Federalist Papers as being part and parcel of their right to regulate interstate commerce. So that if I patent something in Delaware, that patent is enforceable in Georgia. Because Congress backs my right to a patent.
I honestly can't imagine a law that would have more immediate opposition by the entire corporate structure of America than that one.
Other than, like, literally, we should shut all corporations down and try the people who were responsible for them. No, I think that's an immediate no thank you.
Yeah, the creation inherently implies ownership, at least a percentage guaranteed no matter what.
Yeah. And the reason that that's not the case, as you've already noted, Jason, is that, like, everything that was done during the Constitutional Convention, the framers of the Constitution didn't give any more detail on who's responsible for this, or how long should these rights last, or by what mechanism will they be enforced? Yeah, figure it out.
And to their credit, obviously, based on the time, there's a lot of problems and problematic and people and no one's perfect. They were creating an entire fucking government from scratch. So, like, yeah, they gave a framework and probably didn't expect that people would go, ah, my entire personality is slavish devotion to what one person did, you know, the way that we, like, oh, God, I got to write this.
I will say, what happens from the passing of the United States Constitution until the early 20th century is a load of different court cases we do not care about. The first one we're really interested in is in 1902, when Thomas Edison himself argued that film was a mechanical process, but it required an artistic set of skills that made any output, even documentary, an original work that was deserving of the full patent treatment.
I didn't realize I was going to appreciate Thomas Edison.
Yeah, it's Thomas Edison who establishes in the courts that films like Oswald the Lucky Rabbit and Steamboat Willie deserve to be treated as fully patented original inventions, regardless of the content of the movie. The film itself stands as a piece of, as an idea. Even if, again, he says it's a documentary, because you had to cut that documentary. So some artist did something. The next big case that we need to talk about is the 1903 Bleistein versus Donaldson Lithographing Company. So the defendants had made posters advertising a circus, right? And they wanted to copyright the posters. The circus argued that because the posters were only designed to increase sales for the circus, that the inherent value of the poster, therefore, was the circus's. Therefore, the circus owns the poster.
Now, did the circus commission the poster, or was this fan art effectively?
No, they paid the Donaldson Lithographing Company to make these posters.
Okay.
And the company is saying, well, this is our art. We created it. Therefore, we own it. And the circus is saying, well, no, that art only exists for our circus. Therefore, we own it. Now, the Supreme Court upheld that they are not in a position to judge anything as art or having any artistic merit. Therefore, the only merit of this is its monetary value. And so it is, belongs to the company for whom it was commissioned. But
they will know pornography when they see it.
Yeah, but they will know pornography when they see it. So that whole thing that you hate, which is that the distribution company, that Marvel Comics owns all this stuff and that Jack Kirby died in a pauper's grave, vibe, or that Ed Brubaker got paid more money to have a cameo that was cut out of Winter Soldier than he got for having created the Winter Soldier as a character. That whole thing is back to 1903 Supreme Court decision. And it's how we end up with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit being basically the property of Universal Studios and not Walt Disney, because they're the ones who distribute it. Therefore, the monetary value is in the exhibition of the film rather than in the creation of the character.
Now, with Oswald, this is getting deep in the weeds, but was the deal that they actually owned the character, or they had exclusive rights to distribute the character? Great. So, because theoretically, they can't make future Oswald the Rabbit things on their own. It's just that without them, it's a useless intellectual property as film.
Right. So Disney could have, for example, created Oswald the Lucky Rabbit comic strips.
Right.
But if he were to make a film, a short film or a long film.
Why wouldn't you create something original that you can own completely? That's the entire.
Yes. And so it is that experience that's Disney's trauma, losing Oswald and having to create Mickey was a big deal for him. And it's why
he decided to do it to everybody else.
When we move forward to the 1970s, Disney steps forward in being one of the principal players in all the changes to copyright law over the last 50 years, right? So now that we've established that the distributor owns the rights, that made it very easy now for the Walt Disney Company to, of course, own the rights to basically everything they make, which is why you don't start to see like other people doing, say, Peter Pan in animation, or you don't see even though Peter Pan as a property was a different, whole different thing. Like that's a book written by someone in Britain. In fact, fun fact about Peter Pan, still not in the public domain in Britain, and it never will be because Parliament made a special exemption for it.
And now for something completely unrelated.
So in the United Kingdom, if you make anything with Peter Pan, you have to pay a licensing fee.
But why does it get an exception?
Because it's such an important British IP, because it is like an example of Britain in the, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, sort of in that Victorian Edwardian crossover period. It's just decided that it's special and it shouldn't be. It's the Tories who passed the law. They're thinking behind it.
That's a bit silly.
Yeah, they're thinking behind it is they don't want to water it down. But it's dumb because it's in the public domain in the United States and in everywhere in the Commonwealth.
Who owns Peter Pan in England?
It is still owned by the estate, by the estate. I don't remember who wrote Peter Pan.
John Barry?
Yeah, so it's J.M. Barry's.
I'm gonna give myself another B.
Yeah, that's good. So yeah, J.M. Barry does still own, I mean, his estate rather, still owns the rights to Peter Pan. The Peter and Wendy copyright status, it just goes to, it goes to the Great Ormond Street Hospital. Oh, that's nice, actually. That's a children's hospital, Jason.
Okay, I like it now.
Yeah. So but that's because the J.M. Barry estate gives all of its money from Peter and Wendy and so on and so forth to the Great Ormond Street, You could have just taxed people, Parliament, but why would we do that and fund the NHS properly? There's the button. Disney becomes very involved in 1976 with the first changes to copyright law. See, now, as we established in 1902, Edison's like, film equals IP. And then in 1903, distributor has priority over creator. But between 1903 and 1976, a lot had happened, right, Jason?
I would, yes.
Yeah. We had radio, television, computers, all of that. And so there was a real question as to like, okay, well, if you own the film rights, do you then own the television rights? You also may remember that this was a time when
adaptations
the Walt Disney Company, or Walt Disney Studios was putting out, had like a weekly TV show where they
Wonderful
would show
World of
the Wonderful World of Disney. Exactly. So yep. Like, there's a real question. Does someone else have the right to run the TV version?
Remember earlier in this episode when you were like, what do you know about Disney? A lot, mother
Pete. That's why you're very valuable in this set. So, the 1976 Copyright Act extends a bunch of copyright protections. So it separates things out so that TV rights are distinct from film rights, are distinct from adaptation rights, are distinct from like home media distribution. But they all got legacied in. So if you had established, if you already had the rights to the film, you now acquired the rights to the TV. But going forward, you had to separate those out. Part of that, though, was a little bit of a change that Disney was particularly interested in, which is that the statute of limitations also changed on how long a company could have the rights to a piece of intellectual property, and it was extended to a period of 75 years. Previously, there were multiple different approaches. Some was just a fixed number of times, some of it was the life of the creator plus, and then a certain amount of time. The European Union would eventually settle, and this is the standard for the European Union now, on life of the creator plus 70 years. But in 1976, that wasn't the case in the United States. So this is now a new rule, which was designed specifically because Mickey Mouse's IP was going to expire in just a few years.
Now, what happens in the European Union or Britain with the creator plus 70 years, but what if the creator is considered a company rather than an individual?
Not how it works in the European Union. Person who creates it owns it.
So it's that simple. It's that fucking simple. But what if they sell the rights? Be like, because somebody owned Doctor Who, and I assume they don't still own it.
The BBC probably still. Well, that's a good question because European Union didn't exist in the 1960s.
Gotcha. Okay.
And
no one's made anything
Britain
since.
Britain was certainly not a part of it in the 1960s. And you know what? Not a part of it now. So Britain certainly doesn't give a shit what the EU thinks.
There you go. All right.
To bring it up is very traumatic.
Yeah. Brexit is really the full English of the 21st century. It's we got angry at continental breakfast 115, 120 years ago. And now Britain just angry at immigrants? Question mark. So that change in 1976 kicks the can down the road. And then in 1998, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act went through. Now,
he's got you, babe.
Yeah. The thing is, Sonny Bono dead in 1998. He died in a skiing accident. And this copyright
act thing? Like, what a weird.
The Copyright Act got named posthumously for Sonny Bono, despite the fact that Sonny Bono and his child, Chaz Bono, received no benefits from the Copyright Term Extension Act, nor his ex-wife Cher, because they didn't own the rights to the work that they did together anyway.
It was a gesture.
It was just the Republicans trying to get a bill passed by putting the name of a dead congressperson on it. Full stop. What else has changed? So, Sonny Bono's not associated with but named after Copyright Term Extension Act decided to then switch gears from just a fixed 75-year lifespan to life of the creator plus 70 years, which would mean that Steamboat Willie would enter the public domain in... Jason?
2,000-something years ago.
No, in 2024. It just happened like a year ago. Did you not remember? If you go back and watch some John Oliver...
Dude, it's been a long 5 years for me.
It's been a long 5 years. Oh, 2024. And that is why in January of 2024, John Oliver made a full Steamboat Willie costume, and they were like, we're gonna have him say rude things and Disney can't sue us, I guess. Not that they would
anyways, because that sounds like parody.
It's parody law. So all of this to say,
really what that means, honestly, the most immediate consequence of anything going into the public domain is that you will instantaneously get horror movies based on these IPs. That is the only thing that has happened, because porn was already happening. Somehow that was getting away with it as parody. Like parodies.
That's why they all say porn parody. It's
but
under parody
the
law.
Horror movies really are very fearful of the litigation. And as soon as something goes into the public domain, immediately Steamboat Willie is ripping off people's heads, or Winnie the Pooh is fucking mothers up.
Naomi, did you like Blood and Honey, the Winnie the Pooh horror film?
Never heard of it, but need to watch that now.
That's the kind of thing. We got it. Now we understand Naomi's taste.
Yeah, okay. I want to see Winnie the Pooh do some mad shit.
Yeah. All right, now that we've taken our little journey, we've understood the origins of these patents and the marine chronometer, and of course the silly naval disaster, and Disney's role and why Disney cares, right? Of course they want to extend the patents because they don't want to repeat another Oswald situation. We have to ask ourselves an important question, Jason.
But also, Disney as a company is now different than Disney as Walt Disney.
Yes, but that's...
Like his initial
history,
trauma.
In the history of the, yes, that it came to inform quite a lot as they were all like, well, we don't want to have that happen again. Sure. And yes, I would assume that the 1998 investment that Disney made in changing patent law
was more about so that they can continue to protect their intellectual property and the money that they were making.
I mean, 1998, they are riding high.
Yeah, $1 billion industry.
The $1 billion. They're riding high. And if I recall correctly, that means they are just 2 years out from Treasure Planet when they ride low. It's a bad movie. But why does this matter? Well, there was some perhaps unrelated, seemingly, consequences of Disney's push to change intellectual property laws, because those changes to copyright law of intellectual properties like films and books, because if we go back to the constitutional framing of IP law,
it also goes back to inventions,
sciences, and the useful arts. It's all of it comes together. And so patents also had to change. Patents have had a lot of different shifts in their specifics, right? So if you are a company, you will own the patent to an invention, right? That one of your employees may have been the creator of, but as we've already established, the point of creating that was so that the company could make money on it, so the company owns the patent. And what they get to own is not just the specific design, but they can own the core idea behind that specific design. That's one of the big changes that came out of 1976 and 1978's patent law changes. So, for example, when Mylon, who owns the patent for EpiPens, in 2011 redesigned the EpiPen so as to slightly change the ways in which it the spring mechanism operated. Because it was a small novel change, they got to reset their extension on the patent as a direct result of Disney interfering in copyright law. When does the patent on EpiPens expire, Jason?
This century? I mean, maybe even later than that if it's 70 past the creator, and I don't know who's considered the creator. So, I mean, maybe it's even to be determined. Has the person died?
So, that's the trick, isn't it? Companies don't die, do they? So what happens? We then set it to when was the last patent filed? And if it's the first time it was filed, you get 25 years. And then if it's the second time, you get an extension, which can vary. But in this case, it was a 15-year extension. So that patent actually expires this year. But in the meantime, with the shifting of the patent, what happened to the price of EpiPens?
I assume it went up.
Yes. Between 2007 and 2016, the EpiPen price went from $100 per dose to $600 per dose in the United States. Now, what is, Jason, an EpiPen?
EpiPen is a device for delivering epinephrine, which is basically a version of adrenaline. It is basically essential first aid medication for anyone who may suffer anaphylactic allergies.
Yes. If you've got a nut allergy, you probably have an EpiPen. If you're allergic to bee stings, you probably got an EpiPen.
Shellfish,
EpiPen. I know that famous comedian/comedy actor Jason Mantzoukas, egg allergy. If he eats anything with eggs in it, he needs to jab himself with an EpiPen.
Jesus Christ, that one's rough.
It's tough.
That's maybe the toughest I've ever heard. That is the most invisible, and it's in everything. Holy yeah. shit. That man's yes. got to have taken a lot of EpiPens.
Yes, and he will tell you in many interviews how he just doesn't go out to eat that much. It turns out we're just repeating the marine chronometer again. By hoarding this information, there are people dying, or people were dying for a long time because they couldn't afford their EpiPen. Like the patent rules became more and more in favor of the patenter. So it's a bit of a like, really what it is it's two sides of the same coin. If you provide no protections, then people are just going to hoard the information because they are like, fuck you, I'm not going to give it out to you. But if you overprotect it and you really build this fortress, right, then you end up with the EpiPen.
But the difference scenario. Also was that Harrison was an individual.
And Mylon is a corporation.
And those are totally different structures as it relates to pricing. Not to say that individuals can't be fucking assholes, but generally America favors the corporation over the individual. And it is disappointing.
But could we say that he was an asshole because he killed, what, how many million?
1.2 million
people. And he didn't even win the case anyway. So he could have just never done the court case, got the same result, and saved 1.2 million people.
In retrospect, he understood this isn't a situation where, like the EpiPen, where they already know how many people right. are dying and then they raise the price on it. That you wouldn't have any idea of how many people it could have saved until after it's already on the market. And then you go, this is the thing. It's a tough moral question, and I don't know the answer to it. On the one hand, yes, you want to make it available, but wouldn't he have made it available if they had just allowed him the rights to it?
Yeah, he would. So that's the thing. If they had given him the basic natural right protection of, like, I think he only wanted 25 years, which, again, if we're thinking about what Congress was thinking about when they came up with the first real intellectual property laws was the idea that, well, if you've got the rights for like 20, 25 years, which, you know, again, if we're thinking in terms of the 1770s, you're basically talking about you're still talking about quite a healthy chunk of a life.
I mean, at this point, you are talking about more than a quarter of a human life, even in the 2025.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in the 25th century, and that's not true.
And, like, obviously the whole thing of people dying in the late 30s is bullshit. That's, like, on average, and it doesn't – and that accounts – that includes all the infant mortality, which was much higher at the time. But still, a lot of people dying in their 60s. So 25 years is basically half your life, half your adult life at least. So, like, 25 years is a long time. That's sort of – one can imagine that's what the framers of the Constitution were thinking. Was like, yeah, we should have, like, you should have the right for like 25 years, make a little money off of it. And then, you know, then it's done. Then it, you know, and if you're worth anything, if you're a man of genius anyway, a man, want to underscore that. These are the framers of the U.S. Constitution. They left women right the hell out of it. Don't even worry you'd invent something else anyway, right? Like, you know, Thomas Jefferson was out here rewriting the Bible and doing all kinds of wild shit. And all of that to say, the unintended consequences that stemmed from Mickey in the attempt to protect Mickey as a piece of Disney's intellectual property has caused this. EpiPen is just one example. It exists across a broad spectrum of inventions, but industries. Also, again, we've mentioned people like Jack Kirby and Ed Brubaker, who have also been absolutely, I would say, I don't know how do you phrase it. Like, they weren't, I don't think Ed Brubaker's been like devastated, but I mean, like, emotionally, I suppose. He seems fine. But like, he has been robbed, I would argue, by the structure of the intellectual property laws. And the only solution, by the way, that exists at the moment, the bright light at the end of the tunnel, if you want to see it that way, which I think is fair, is that we didn't have to wait until 2025 for a generic alternative to be designed for the EpiPen, because people were so angry and created such a furor in the years in which they were like, hey, it won't be until 2025 that we can have a generic pen, but they cost $600 a pop. That's insane. That in 2018, the FDA approved Teva Pharmaceuticals to make a generic EpiPen, which is like $50 instead of $600. And in 2022, Mylan did have to pay $264 million in a lawsuit in Kansas, which amounts to 0.32 days of their money.
What was the lawsuit? Why did they? What, like,
people sued them for monopolized for being a monopoly, for trying to block out any competition in the market.
So how much does an EpiPen cost now?
$50. Well, I mean, if you want the name brand, it's probably more, but it has gone down to a
competitive rate.
Fine, better than 600. I mean, the price should be zero, but because it's you shouldn't ask someone to pay to not die. You shouldn't put a gun to someone's head and be like, give me $50 or I pull the trigger. That's what we do when we charge people $50 for an EpiPen. Apologies if you disagree with me, listener, but in my opinion, there is no difference. It is the same thing. The American healthcare system is murder. So, patents, copyrights. Yes, we should ensure that creators get compensation. And I would even say it is fair that the Walt Disney Corporation should be able to hold on to, as a distributor, rights to certain things.
It's an easy solution that won't be popular, but it's just that you set a percentage that any idea is owned jointly by the creator, who is the employee or work for hire person, as well as the distributor or greater company. And you figure out whatever that profit share is and you set that up. And then you also have people who are more willing and able to continue to contribute their original ideas to corporate cultures and universes.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? So, right. That automatic right, which Disney wants to pursue and keep hold of as long as possible, it has serious consequences, whether it's for 18th century sailors or 21st century allergen sufferers.
I think one of the takeaways, it's not maybe the most important part of this show, but I do think it's worth thinking about, is the way that we pass on our traumas to other people. So Disney, based on the way that you were describing it, experienced a great loss of Oswald the Rabbit and therefore wanted to make sure that he was able to protect Mickey and other characters that he created and was able to have ownership. At this point in time, Disney is quite possibly the greatest IP sort of holder. They own the intellectual property to so many different brands. It's insane. That is millions of creators who have experienced some degree of the same thing that Walt Disney experienced. Now, your perspective may be cool. Disney learned the lesson. He did his thing. That's the nature of capitalist, to which I would say, okay, that's an intellectual argument that is built on pragmatic cruelty. I hate those arguments. They make me sad. Why are those your values? It's really disappointing that we pass on this kind of generational punishment to creators based on, okay, this happened to me, so now it's okay to happen to other people, as opposed to this happened to me, so I'm going to try and make the world a better place for other people and protect my slice of the pie because I also want to make sure that I can do cool shit for the rest of my life. I think it's so interesting that in IP law, the artistic elements are considered of equal weight as the scientific inventions. Yeah. It speaks to a understanding in America from its founding fathers, motherfuckers, the people that you think are the gods of this country, that the arts were as important as the sciences to creating the identity and the culture and the future investment in America. So what the fuck is this bullshit now where we are trying to make it seem like that is not the case, where arts are constantly marginalized or said to be less important? We have talked at length in the past that culture is the means of influence, and it is how we tell the story of our nations to other nations as well. It is incredibly important. It's just a constant refrain. And I think that that is something that I took from this as well, that these two things are innately associated in our Constitution. Stop trying to make it seem like one is more important than the other, though obviously medicine is more important. I had no idea that the marine chronometer is the beginning of modern day intellectual property law. That's crazy. I knew that we measured the sea by knots. Did not know that that literally meant they tied knots in ropes and then tried to count them. Also, I learned a lot about clocks. I didn't realize I was so deficient in my knowledge about clocks. I didn't realize how much shame I would be made to feel not knowing about clocks.
So embarrassing. So embarrassing.
Yeah. Tick-tock. There's only one clock that comes for us all. And that's the siren song of death, which means that we're towards the end of this episode. Andrew, was there anything in the investigation of these ideas and the doing of your research that you want to share behind
the
scenes?
That's not where I thought that sentence was going.
No, it's not where I thought I was going to go either. And that's usually where I head at the end of a sentence. But we had a little role reversal there. Listen, this is one of the most straightforward episodes to put together. Like, I was just happened upon the marine chronometer, and then I went, oh, it's just like Disney. What I want to recommend instead of a research process here is, you may be right now, especially after Jason's death clock line, feeling a little down, and I want to remind you that there are many systems out there, alternatives. There are processes you can engage with, which put like a positive energy into the world. You can support things through what's called a boycott. Instead of not buying things from companies you don't like, you buy things from companies that you agree with. And if you don't like all this stuff and you think, oh, what Jason was saying was good, look for companies that are cooperatives. Because in cooperatives, the whole point is everybody gets a share and nobody gets screwed. And if you cannot steal a Disney Plus subscription from your father-in-law who accidentally signed up for it, then I highly recommend you look into Canopy, K-A-N-O-P-Y. It is a free streaming app that you get access to through the local library. If you're in the United States or the United Kingdom or most EU countries, you can stream movies just like on Netflix, but the library did it instead of you giving money to Netflix. So, Canopy, everybody. Check it out.
If you'd like to make sure that we have money, you can subscribe to our Patreon for only $2 a month, far cheaper than any of the streaming services we've described herein. You get a bonus episode of Seemingly Unrelated every single month. There's other ways that you could help support us as well. Go ahead, rate, review, share, subscribe, anything that tickles the old algorithm and helps people know about this show helps us tremendously. Spread the gift of Seemingly Unrelated far and wide. We're easily accessible and for the most part free, so spread the word. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember to tune in and stay curious.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production, created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone and Jason Howard. Audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly unrelatedpod.com.